This is The Urban Political,
the podcast on urban theory, research, and activism.
Welcome to The Urban Political. My name is Markus Kipp, and today I'm fortunate to talk about digital community organizing with Nathan.
I'm Nathan Schneider, and I'm an assistant professor of media studies at University of Colorado Boulder. I run a small new lab called the Media Enterprise Design Lab, and our work is all about bringing democracy to how we do the media economy and helping think through models for community ownership and governance.
Great to meet you, Nathan. This is the first episode of the series After Corona, Advancing Urban Society, in which we discuss what our confrontation with the corona pandemic reveals about the urban fabric, how our lives are transforming, and we pick apart opportunities and threats of this crisis for advancing urban society. If you have a question for our guests, please do get in touch with us via email, Twitter, or Instagram. Each month, we will give them the chance to respond in this podcast. In today's talk, Nathan will help us explore the role of digital media for community organizing in a moment of self-isolation and physical distancing. To begin, Nathan, how do digital media support forms of community organizing in response to the corona outbreak? Could you give us some insights?
Well, you know, I think like a lot of people, I'm still kind of trying to understand what's going on and trying to follow it, but it's amazing how how many groups have sprung up around the world to enable people to help each other, you know, under the banner often of mutual aid, this old anarchist concept of people actually stepping into the world and helping each other. It's a challenging concept because it you know, historically relies on people being together and being in contact. And this is an experience where people kind of have to be apart in a certain respect. And you know, another sort of activity that's been building is in some ways one historically better suited to this kind of moment is this logic of peer production, which is people, you know, we think of like open source software projects and things like that, which is people generally physically separated from each other, but individually doing coordinated activity toward common goals. And so you see projects out there like attempts to create open ventilator designs and attempts to crowdsource information and share information to create a better picture of what is actually going on with the pandemic. So there's a range of different kinds of activities out there. It's been really striking to me to see, you know, which kinds of activities might be easier to manifest and more possible to manifest. You know, I've spent so much of recent years focused on the cooperative movement, you know, cooperative businesses and enterprises and so forth. And these, you know, historically really depend on people coming together, often going to meetings and being in the same spaces together. And I think as a result of that, you know, this cooperative movement has been really challenged by this kind of outbreak. And there's even evidence to suggest back in 1918 in the flu pandemic then, cooperatives really struggled for perhaps some of the same reasons. You know, we have to recognize, you know, where we can find solidarity and where we might have difficulty finding solidarity at a moment where we need to be physically distant.
Could you give us a few examples of such digitally enabled forms of community organizing or peer production?
You know, one resource that I found really interesting was developed by a community in London called Newspeak House, and it's called the Coronavirus Tech Handbook. And it's a crowdsourced, based on Google Doc, Docs directory of all sorts of things that are happening on the scientific front, on in terms of mutual aid groups, much more. Just lots of information about the state of affairs from a kind of grassroots perspective, with a focus on the tech community and what people who are involved in technology can do. Other examples are just this huge proliferation of mutual aid groups. There's these maps, for instance. There's COVID-19 Mutual Aid UK, which is the directory in the UK. An organization called It's Going Down has a directory online that's at itsgoingdown.org. And there are just local groups all over the place. Mutual Aid Hub is one in the US that's a map of mutual aid groups across the country where people are organizing things like grocery delivery to elders and all this sort of thing. And then there are there's a project called helpwithcovid.com, and it's a directory that's kind of a online marketplace in a way where people can share projects that need help, what kind of help they need, and people can get plugged in and volunteer to participate. So these projects range from, creating new directories and working on some of those open scientific projects to just volunteering in one's community, these sorts of things. So it's pretty remarkable to see a lot of the stuff that's come up in response. I hope these kinds of examples help. At the same time, I feel, as maybe others feel, like a bit lost in the sense that, I'm at homeschooling my kids, not having a lot of physical contact with people in my community, and I feel like I'm flying blind a little bit. In a sense, probably we all are, and find that I have less ability to really ascertain what is out there than I might ordinarily be able to have a sense of by going to a local meeting or the like. We're kind of trusting these networks to carry us.
Currently, social media plays a key role for us in staying socially connected with our colleagues and comrades when we can't meet physically. The biggest go-to platforms are provided by Facebook, Skype, Twitter, Zoom, Instagram, Google, etc., that are at least partially free of charge. What are the implications of using these platforms? And how are these corporations profiting from our use?
Well, I can't speak for the corporations or their balance sheets, but certainly, we're entering a kind of vulnerability there. If we're relying on these tools to communicate much more than we have in the past, we're handing them our data, we're handing them, our reliance, our allegiance. And we need to be very careful about that. One thing that's been interesting to notice, at least among technologists, is there's been a lot of discussion lately in these past few days and weeks about Zoom, which is a tool that lots of people are using. Unlike Google and Facebook and Amazon, it's a company that hasn't drawn a lot of scrutiny in the past. And people are kind of scrutinizing its terms of service and trying to understand what kind of data it's really collecting. And, we notice that, if you're making a certain kind of presentation, the host can see whether somebody's actually looking at the Zoom screen or not, whether it's the highlighted program on their computer. So it's there are a lot of unknowns here. At the same time, I think there's an opportunity that we're really missing to build on and support the open collaboration tool ecosystem, which is really quite extensive and something that I've been kind of forcing myself and my students through our lab to explore. For our lab, for instance, we run a series of all open source tools that we use to collaborate, a cloud file hosting service called Nextcloud, a chat platform called Rocket Chat, and a series of other tools that we use to interact and to work together. And we run and control and manage these tools, and it creates a different kind of collaboration experience, right? And one in which the tools are under our control. They're community developed tools. Nobody is using them for surveillance. There's no mystery about what the business model is. You know, we pay for our own hosting to support these tools. And it presents a real opportunity for people to be able to, especially as they become more reliant on this kind of digital collaboration, to make sure that they really have a say and have control over how these tools work. And one way of doing this is to form digital cooperatives that can run these tools collectively, because it can be, you know, frustrating and difficult to run them yourself. I know from experience, but I'm also a member of a cooperative called May First, which is a longstanding tech co-op, mainly set up for activists in New York and Mexico, across the U.S. and Latin America. May First offers that Next Cloud service. May First offers its members Jitsi video chat. So, an alternative to Zoom and Google Hangouts and the like, and a variety of other services. And that way, you know, we rely on a group of software administrators who manage the tools for us, so we don't have to worry about it day to day. And it's a really nice way of doing this sort of thing. It's a model where you can get a lot of the same services, sometimes even better services. You pay a bit, but you have the peace of mind knowing that your tools are being managed by somebody who's accountable to you rather than accountable to some distant shareholders.
Can you tell me a bit more about the conditions for digital cooperatives to thrive, particularly with respect to the critical situation today? What does it mean for them to be able to continue functioning or maybe even expanding?
Well, I would hope that this kind of cooperative focus on these digital services could actually expand in a moment like this, could demonstrate that they have a real usefulness and could find new members and new clients. Lots of other kinds of businesses are really struggling at a moment like this, but I imagine, the digital collaboration tools are having a bit of a field day, and it would be wonderful to see some cooperative alternatives enjoying some of that growth opportunity. I'm not sure, I haven't checked in with them about, whether that's actually happening, but there's been at least some interesting discussion on social media about how these might work. But it's an opportunity that we should take up. We should recognize that in a moment where we're more dependent than ever on digital tools, that we make sure we have digital tools that we can trust.
Do you have any insights about the demographics of the users in these online communities? I'm particularly interested in how social divisions and forms of marginalization in the offline world get mirrored in cyberspace.
It really depends. So, for instance, some of them will really rely on some of the demographic limits of tech culture in general. So, for instance, one that I'm part of is called social.coop. It's a social media platform using the Mastodon open source platform that is kind of a Twitter-like interface and experience. And it's a wonderful tool, and we have a shared, it's called an instance, that's cooperatively owned and managed. And And it tends to be kind of the early adopter techie type. That involves all sorts of, homogeneities that follow along the types of people who tend to be kind of empowered as technologists in our society today. On the other hand, May 1st, which I mentioned earlier, is an organization that for many years has made a very strong commitment to elevating the voice and power of marginalized people, communities of color, activists who are working embedded in that are part of some of the most marginalized communities in North America and Central America. And as a result, what that organization looks like is quite different. And so it really depends how they're set up and what the kind of intentional organizing methods are. But I'm very proud to be part of that I'm proud to be part of both projects, and they each have their value. But I'm especially grateful for those who for years have been working to build May 1st on the basis of that kind of intentionality about working with and among and as the people who need this technology most.
On that backdrop, tell me a bit more about your recent project called Community Rule, which is a governance toolkit for online community building. So, how do these online tools differ from offline community building, and why do we need such tools?
This is a fun project for me. It's come out of a very out of direct experience. It's been kind of an outgrowth of an ongoing recognition through my work as an administrator of a mailing list and other communities, online community spaces for the Platform Cooperative Network. So this is a network of people who are trying to build digital cooperatives. So we have a mailing list of about 500 people, open discussion list, and a few other things like that. One thing I noticed is here's a group of people who would love to operate democratically because that's what the community is all about. And yet, the tools that we have available, whether it's a Facebook group or an email list or whatever, really aren't equipped for democratic practice. And it made me realize how, I did some research around this. Draft paper is available and that sort of thing, on how this kind of logic of implicit feudalism, as I call it, has pervaded the technologies that we use for building community online, and that really there's a deep bias in these technologies for people to have power that is basically unaccountable, and where any gesture toward democracy requires a lot of extra effort. So there are these outlier cases like Wikipedia and this sort of thing where you have democratic practice, but they had to work really hard to get that and to establish the underlying rules. So, one thing that also really excited me was there's a project called the Contributor Covenant, which is a code of conduct that thousands of open source software projects have adopted. And it was developed by a fantastic activist in the open source community, Coralineda Emke. And just adopting this thing in our platform co-op communities really helped us address some particular challenges we had in the community, just to have some rules on hand. But I realized that that code of conduct doesn't include governance. It tells you what's not allowed, but it doesn't tell you who is in charge and how they got there. And so Community Rule is an effort to do is to like with the Contributor Covenant, to just make it easy for communities to adopt a simple template or adapt a template for how power works in their community. This is often I think of it as a layer in the stack of community building that's often missing. and community rules, an effort to make that governance layer in the stack more available. So we have a set of templates, things like a simple elected board structure or a jury system or a kind of petition-based governance system or even the standard benevolent dictator for life, you know, that implicit feudalism that we so often see, and enables groups to make much more explicit what is our underlying governance practice. And I think this is especially important among these new mutual aid groups that are showing up right now. You know, I've spent a lot of time, you know, covering and working with social movements. And one of the deep, you know, most persistent failures I've seen and many others have observed, you know, this goes back to, for instance, Joe Freeman's famous essay from the early 70s, The Tyranny of Structurelessness, that activist groups so often, you know, when they're formed in a very energized moment, they don't think about governance. They think that, you know, we'll have this excitement and this common purpose forever, and we'll always be able to solve our problems in that way. But, you know, usually after any amount of time passes, if an organization doesn't have those basic questions answered of who holds power and how and why, they can really tear themselves apart. So as these new organizations, these new mutual aid groups are forming, you know, I hope that they have, you know, I would love for this kind of toolkit to make it easier for them to, to get their governance house in order, before the difficult questions really strike. And so they have some framework for addressing those questions, and they can focus on the work that really matters rather than agonizing over basics that should have been addressed from the start. It's striking how, you know, if you think of your average Facebook group, you know, they're really using much more primitive governance practices than even like, you know, a typical, you know, fraternal organization or garden club or, you know, like your local average community organization full of, you know, often elderly people. You know, usually they have, you know, established governance structures and practices, you know, that are kind of no-brainers. And yet our vast online communities have none of that and are relying on this kind of strange regressive feudal logic while pretending that they're advanced and of the future. So, you know, I in some ways, the goal of this project is to help online communities just kind of catch up to how to the best practices of offline governance.
I'd like to come back to the digital cooperatives and the urban dimension. In 2018, you published the book called Everything for Everyone: How the Radical Tradition is Shaping the Next Economy. And in that book, looking at the cooperative movement, you argued that it could gain new vigor by drawing on digital technologies. However, you also noted a disconnect between the tradition of established local cooperatives and the emergence of new digital co-ops. So please elaborate on this for us.
You know, right now, a lot of the cooperative legacy is really operating out of methodologies and practices and also public policies that were designed, you know, generations ago. And meanwhile, especially since 2008, as you mentioned, you know, there's been a real resurgence of young people trying to form new kinds of cooperatives, especially in the digital context. And, you know, in a lot of ways, the challenge is there's a major disconnect between these two, between, you know, for instance, here in Colorado, where I live, there's a $130 billion cooperative bank, you know, that was set up through farmer organizing beginning a century ago. And so there's lots of capital in the cooperative sector. But, you know, among the young people trying to start technology cooperatives, you know, that bank is not equipped to, you know, to support them, is not a kind of live option for them at this point. And this kind of pattern recurs all in different ways all over the world. And so on the one hand, there's this new energy. On the other hand, there's there's this powerful legacy to build on, but they haven't quite met each other yet. And I think that's, you know, really the opportunity that we have to enable us to transform our communities so that as we have before with cooperative enterprise, so that we really have the capacity, for instance, to create, you know, rideshare cooperatives and ways of providing the benefits of a kind of platform economy in a way that's also accountable to our communities in fundamental ways. And so, you know, I really think of it as an opportunity that we have to decide whether we want to take. Do we want to ensure that, you know, as we did in the U.S. In the 1930s, there was a decision that, you know, it would be possible for communities to form local credit unions, local cooperative banks. There was a decision that rural areas that didn't have electricity because investors didn't want to invest in them could form their own cooperatives and provide their own electricity and get public financing to do it. You know, we need to decide that we really do want accountable online platforms and accountable public infrastructure and you know, build the ecosystem required to do that. Right now, you know, we don't have that ecosystem, and there's a lot of brave pioneering people trying to build the next generation of cooperatives, in some cases, you know, succeeding. But they're up against a lot, and it's time, you know, to make a public decision about, you know, ensuring that these kinds of businesses have the same opportunities or better than in businesses that are mainly designed just to enrich investors.
What could such public choices mean concretely in the face of Uber, Lyft, and so on?
Well, I'll give you an example. So, for instance, here in the U.S., a few years ago, the city of Austin, Texas, you know, a major tech hub, decided that city council decided that they were going to require Uber and Lyft to follow the law. So they were going to require these ride-sharing companies to fingerprint drivers, just like taxi drivers, you know, were fingerprinted just for public safety reasons. And the companies refused to accept this this requirement and actually left the city. And in response, the city council set up, enabled the establishment of a nonprofit rideshare company called Ride Austin, and a cooperative of taxis called, ATX Taxi Co-op, and you know, these services worked well. You know, the Ride Austin was a, you know, perfectly usable and affordable rideshare option. I've used it. You know, it turns out that, you know, building a rideshare service isn't rocket science, and it's possible to do without, you know, the mega billions of Uber and Lyft. And it's a reminder that when we stop allowing these companies to break our laws and to sneak into our communities and take over, and instead, you know, demand that we're going to get these services in a better way, you know, we really can do it. And there are all sorts of ways in which we could make that demand. You know, for instance, agreeing that we're not going to allow surveillance capitalism to rule our digital lives. So just like phone companies aren't allowed to listen in on your conversations and then send you, you know, quote unquote relevant robocalls from advertisers. What if we just decided that this idea of reading everybody's emails and then, you know, sending ads in response is not okay, and, you know, force better kinds of business models to emerge instead. I think we're getting to a moment where we're starting to be ready for that, where we're starting to establish rules that, you know, that, that, are putting some meaningful constraints. You know, I think there's some dangers in some of the directions that, for instance, GDPR went in, which you know, the major European privacy rules, which you know, in some ways just kind of raise the compliance burden for a lot of these companies. You know, I hope that we can set up a new set of frameworks that will actually encourage innovation and support, you know, a wider range of smaller kinds of businesses in the tech economy that can be more dynamic and responsive to people. You know, we really have that opportunity. And you know, cases like Austin remind us that that we don't need these big companies in order to get these kinds of services. Or we can be much more careful about how we, you know, what we allow and what we don't allow. And sometimes that means just applying old-fashioned rules, like rules created for phone companies, to the internet. Stop pretending that the internet is some completely new territory in which old ideas, you know, are no longer relevant. In fact, you know, a lot of the things we need, a lot of the guidance and restraint that we need on, you know, on the internet, or, you know, can come from, you know, practices that, you know, were applied to older forms of media. And further, you know, we need mechanisms for self-regulation so that governments don't have to take that whole burden of regulation, but instead users themselves can co-govern and have a voice, you know, and have a democratic place in their networks. And that's what the, you know, the platform cooperativism work is all about. It's about ensuring that, you know, that it's okay for, or ensuring that it's a norm for people who are relying on certain digital tools to really have a voice in those networks.
Thank you very much, Nathan, for sharing your thoughts.
Thanks to you for listening.
For more information, visit our website urbanpolitical.podigy.io.
Please subscribe and follow us on Twitter.